I was amused by one of the joys that was shared this morning. In a minute, you'll know why. I have heard some of my UU colleagues say that they don't do theme weddings. By this, they mean weddings in which a participant's attire, as well as the decor and perhaps the actual location, mimic a time and place out of the ordinary. For example, a medieval wedding theme. Now, I have never actually been asked to be in costume for a wedding, and I'm not really sure where I would draw the line. But I'm not against the concept of a theme wedding. My only requirement is that I know that the couple is serious about the vows they will make and the marriage that will follow. In truth, I think that all of my colleagues do theme weddings, even the ones who say they do not. Because I would argue, as I think was suggested in our joy this morning, that bride or brides in white dresses with veils and groom or grooms in tuxedos and waistcoats is in fact a theme wedding. It just happens to be our culture's dominant theme wedding. Now that I live here in Orlando, I think of it as the princess wedding theme. Because really, the attire and decor of those weddings has nothing to do with the real lives of the people involved. And that's okay. There are times when we set ourselves apart and celebrate that we are doing something special, that this time and this place is special, a time when we present ourselves in a way that represents our hopes and our dreams, a way that is full of metaphor and meaning. So today is Halloween. It's a time when people are prone to dressing up and wearing costumes. And I'm not sure that I would claim that our Halloween costumes all represent our hopes and dreams in quite the same way that wedding attire does. But it would be interesting to look at them through the lens of metaphor and meaning. We can't always read a lot into another person's choice for a Halloween costume, as I know that I and many other people often dress up in whatever's handy or convenient when time is pressed. I wouldn't want to judge too much by that. But I do think it's fun to see what people choose and how they represent or disguise themselves. Are they being who they really are but haven't told us? Are they telling us about who they wish they were, or who they are afraid they might be? Or are they simply telling us something about their sense of humor? I understand the wearing of costumes in many of our Halloween traditions to be modern interpretations or cultural appropriations of the Celtic celebration of Samhain. Now, the word Samhain means summer's end, and the festivals associated with it are harvest festivals. For those neo-pagans who draw on the Celtic tradition, Samhain is the new year. Now, I want to note here the tremendous diversity among those who claim the title pagan or are in one of the earth-centered traditions, and just say that an exploration of the difference between those traditions is beyond the scope of this morning, but I want to acknowledge that other traditions use different language, celebrate different holidays, and use different mythologies. Today, we're focused on one celebration within one tradition. Now, although I do not consider myself a pagan, I do find most of my spirituality grounded in the natural world. And I've long been intrigued by the idea of marking the year by the eight Sabbaths, as is done in some of the earth-centered traditions. These include the winter solstice, the spring equinox, the summer solstice, the fall equinox, and the four holidays that fall at the midpoint of those seasons. Samhain is the midpoint, falling halfway between the fall equinox and the winter solstice. Since Halloween happens to fall on a Sunday this year, it seemed like a good time to deepen my understanding of what holds meaning for those who do celebrate Samhain on a regular basis. To do that, I chatted with some of the folks who do that, including Mary, thank you very much, and others. Now, my prior understandings were based on, among other things, attendance at Samhain services in the past, and I was glad to know that at least my basics weren't far off. But what was new to me this time was really thinking about the way an acknowledgement of ancestors figures into the season. As Mary explained, at Samhain, it's believed that the veil that separates the world between the living and the dead is thinnest, and it makes it more possible to cross through. And it's more likely that spirits will come into our world. Traditionally, the trouble is that people didn't know whether those spirits were up to good or ill. And so people would disguise themselves so that they wouldn't be recognized by those that were up to mischief. Now, I can't help but make a side note here. I couldn't help but notice that our elections are held during this season. And I'm just wondering about those advertisements and the apparent wearing of costumes that dress one candidate up as all good and the other as evil. Must this be so? What would happen if we presented our candidates decked out as who they really are? And how about if we decked out the other candidates too? Are we willing to see the truth behind their disguises? And can we really tell who is up to good and who is up to mischief? It actually appears that the elections are not held by coincidence at this time, but really quite intentionally at the same time as Samhain, because at the time that the date for the elections were set, it was an agrarian society, and so they wanted to fit into that window between when the harvest would be in, so people weren't too busy to go vote, but before the snow flew, so before the winter made it impossible to get to the polls. But now that we don't live in such an agrarian society, I think maybe we should consider a different time of year and see if we can come up with a different sort of election season. But that's a digression. As I was saying, traditionally people dress themselves up to protect themselves from spirits who might want to do them harm. And this is apparently hard to tell. Now, I know there are lots of families which have what we might discreetly call colorful histories. In some cases, I can certainly understand why someone might not want to get tangled up with their deceased ancestors. But I wondered, what about ancestors that one feels warmly toward or thinks highly of? I mean, are those still a problem? And I came to understand that they could be. Think about it. Times change. Things we do in our world might have been unthinkable or unimaginable several generations back, or even just one. I mean, in some cases, even our living relatives don't understand why we live the way we live. Why would the dead? Here's just a few examples of things that have changed very rapidly. Living with a partner without the benefit of marriage. Having a partner of the same gender. Changing religions. Voting for a different political party. There are all sorts of things that might be hard to explain to my beloved grandfather who died 46 years ago. Now, I mentioned in a recent orientation session for our new visitors that one of the things I like about being in a UU community is being with people who believe things that I don't. It helps me to know what I believe and improves my ability to explain it. So learning about this ancestral concern is an excellent example for me. While reflecting on it, I realized two things. The first is my naturalistic view of what happens after death is simply that of returning to the earth. We live on in the memories of those we love and in the way we have touched others. Now, I knew that part about me before, but I also realized in thinking about this that if there is a conscious existence after death, my assumption would be that we would become all-knowing and that the living wouldn't have to explain themselves to us. So follow my logic here. I don't believe in life after death, but if I'm wrong, I have a very strong opinion about how it should work. I didn't know that about myself before. Now, this might not seem very important, but it can be. For example, I was talking with a man whose father had died before the father had ever accepted his son's sexual orientation. Now, for better or for worse, the son was left to process the troubles in their relationship on his own, and the son was expressing his dismay about the situation. How are we to be helpful? Now, I look at this as a minister, but you might look at it as a friend or simply as someone trying to help another human being in their time of grief. At such times, my beliefs do not matter. Neither do yours. But it is good for us to know our own beliefs, so that we do not inflict them on the bereaved. Has anybody ever had somebody else's beliefs inflicted on them when they were mourning? A lot of us have had comments that aren't all that helpful. So let me suggest one thing that's not helpful. Well, he wasn't very accepting of you, so it's just as well he's gone. I don't know why you're upset. People really say things like that. But looking at a kinder thing we might say, if I am not aware of the assumption that I make that the dead, if conscious, would be all-knowing and therefore realize that there was nothing wrong with the situation they had judged during life, I might say, well, now he realizes that his view of you was wrong and he knows that your love should be honored. Now, that sounds much kinder, but it's not really very helpful if that is not the same theological position that this young man is coming from. Both of those are simplistic answers that are based in the speaker's theology and that let us off the hook really easily. So for those of you who are waiting eagerly for me to tell you the simple yet helpful thing to say, don't be holding your breath. There isn't one. The gift that we can give when we are with someone in mourning is to dwell in the discomfort with them, remembering that it is their discomfort, not ours. We can ask about his theology and how he understands the possibilities for resolution at this time. We cannot fix it. We can help him understand his beliefs and explore how they can support him. We can companion one another, but we companion one another best when we are clear about what we ourselves believe. So think back to when you were reflecting on ancestors, personal, cultural, and spiritual, during the meditation. Does the pattern of your thought offer you any insight into what you believe about those ancestors or your relationship to them? Do you need to reconcile any relationships? Is that possible? How is it possible? Are you concerned about whether or not your ancestors would approve of your life today? Why? Why not? Now, turn it around. What kind of ancestor would you like to be? Will you leave behind unreconciled relationships? Will you hold future generations accountable to standards applicable in your lifetime? I'm always a little concerned when someone has a last wish or a deathbed request that is too specific. Someone, out of love for this person, promises that they will never or always do something. And maybe that's a good thing, but maybe it's not. Because I don't believe that revelation is sealed, I think there's always more to know. And I'd like to leave open the possibility that new information will require different action. There are people I have thought of as meddling from the grave. You know, they're gone and they're still controlling people's lives. So what kind of ancestor do you want to be? Here's a little story about a spiritual ancestor from the Unitarian side of our tradition. This is William Ellery Channing, whose words we read earlier in the responsive reading. A few years back, I had the opportunity to serve as the treasurer for the Unitarian Sunday School Society. It was a great position because my main function was to write really big checks for people who had been awarded grant requests, and it was for people developing curriculum for use in our congregations. Now, the Unitarian Sunday School Society was founded in 1827 by William Ellery Channing and others. Now, Channing was an important figure in early Unitarianism. He's, as I said, the author of that reading that we shared a few minutes ago, but he's also the person who gave us the name Unitarian, because at the time that Channing lived, it was actually a slur that was used against people with a liberal theological leaning. And he claimed it proudly, much the way people in certain groups today claim the word that people want to use against them. And in so doing, he took the negative power away. Well, in 1827, Channing and others founded this Unitarian Sunday School Society to support the development of this new Unitarian movement that he was helping to found. So 170 years later, in an office not far from where Channing had served, I was sitting in a board meeting of the Unitarian Sunday School Society, and we were reviewing grant applications according to standards that had been established well before any of us were on that board. Now, up until that time, a successful grant application had been an expansion of the theme, "I request funding to develop a curriculum for this age group on this topic, and this is important for the following three reasons." But on the day in question, we were stumped. Out of five applications before us, two intriguing and really actually exciting proposals did not fit our standard form. In particular, they were for the development of electronic tools for use in curriculum development and implementation. Someone said, "We can't fund these. Our standard says we only fund the development of specific new curriculum." There was discomfort around the table. It was a true statement. And yet, we knew it was wrong. After a few minutes of confused silence, finally someone said, "Well, what would Channing do?" What would Channing do? And it was the right question, not because we owe a debt to Channing for founding the society, but because Channing was a pioneer in his day, and it was clear that a pioneering spirit was needed. Of course, we could not scour Channing's writing for the place where he had said, "And thou shalt fund the development of DVDs and online training when given the opportunity." We could, however, invoke his bold spirit. We could invoke his bold spirit that clearly would have said, "Be on the lookout always for new and exciting ways to share this faith and communicate its important message. And then we knew that it was time for our tried and true funding standards to change. It was time to evolve. When we look to the men and women who have walked the road before us, we look not for specific answers, but for direction and inspiration. Their answers were for their day. Our answers need to be for ours. As the start of a new year, Samhain is a time of beginnings. Reflection on our relationship with our ancestors is a great way to get right with the past before we move into the future. So, what baggage do we carry that belongs to someone else? Can we set it down? What expectations do we try to live up to? What barriers do we imagine are in our way? And must it be so? Or might an improved relationship with our past, personal, cultural, spiritual, release us so that we may see what we are called to in our time? May we honor our ancestors best by living into the very best that they have left to us. And may our reflections make it so. Please join me in a moment of silence and reflection.